This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Almost anyone could see the new coronavirus boiling up in China back in December. In a global world, it was bound to come here. But still, most other countries did not react and prepare. Now leading scientists have another warning. Extreme and deadly heat is not just the future. It is already here. Will we listen this time? From the UK's University of Exeter, Professor Tim Lenton explains the climate niche where most of humanity lives. But that zone is shifting, and billions of people will migrate away from uninhabitable countries, mostly northward toward the poles. And that's not centuries, but mere decades from now. Then Dr. Radley Horton from Columbia University warns killer heat and humidity are already popping up around the world, including in the United States. Human productivity, crops, and lives are already suffering, with much more to come in a rapidly warming world. Like the virus, the arriving greenhouse world doesn't care if you believe it, deny it, or postpone action till later. Now we are in a race to keep as much Earth as we can within limits dictated by our health. New science finds home to billions of humans now living could become uninhabitable due to climate change. Some plants, as we know, only live within narrow temperature bands. But now we learn that is possibly true of humans as well. But temperatures are changing, the planet is warming. In fact, people living during the next 50 years will see changes greater than in any human history. Professor Timothy Lenton is director of the Global Systems Institute at UK's University of Exeter. He returns to Radio EcoShock as co-author of a benchmark paper published this May in the journal Nature. It's called Future of the Human Climate Niche. Beyond the startling headlines, we find a new understanding of humans and where we live. Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me back, Alex.
Well, this paper got headlines in the European and American press saying billions of people will find themselves in extreme heat zones. Could global warming really take us beyond our tolerance levels so soon?
That's the worrying conclusion we've had to come to from doing this work. It's not the case for everybody, but it's the case for large numbers of often already vulnerable people that they will be set to experience climates that hardly anyone or even no one experiences today on the hot end. And yeah, we were quite flabbergasted with the kind of numbers that were coming out of our analysis.
Well, let's delve into the fundamental concept of a human niche. How do you define that?
Well, what inspired our study, I suppose, was a sort of question an ecologist would ask, which is, are humans just like any other animal in the sense that they have a preferred range of climates, temperatures and rainfalls at which they like to live? I mean, we don't find elephants on the ice sheets and we don't find penguins in the savannah. We, of course, find humans all over the planet, but not at the same population density. I mean, the population density is very low if you're an Inuit in the Arctic or indeed a pastoralist on the edge of the Sahara, for example. So what we did was we looked carefully in available data at what is the population density of people as a function of temperature and of rainfall. And we were quite stunned by the results, which is that there's a clear peak in human population density centered on about 13 degrees centigrade mean annual temperature. There's a secondary peak of density of people living mostly in the Indian subcontinent in hotter and wetter conditions. There's quite a gap in the middle. There's not a lot of population density around 20 degrees centigrade on the annual average, which in a European context is like the north coast of Africa. And of course, the population density drops off at really low temperatures and really high temperatures. And there's hardly anywhere on the surface of the Earth that goes above about 29 degrees centigrade on the annual average. And one of the issues we looked at with the future was how climate change is going to push many people, potentially billions of people, to be living out at the top end at temperatures greater than 29 degrees C.
You and your co-authors say that while some places will become as hot as the Sahara Desert is today, other regions could actually develop a more habitable climate. Can you give us some examples?
So what we're thinking about here is the idea that the best conditions, if they're indeed defined as, say, 13 degrees centigrade on the annual average, those conditions are moving poleward in a simple sense, and they're sort of moving up mountains where mountains exist. So I guess if you thought about it in the Americas, it's like a shift in what's currently the optimum is moving from somewhere in the US, possibly across or approaching the Canadian border, certainly.
I took a look, and first of all, you're talking about 13 degrees C. For our North American listeners, that's a mean annual temperature in the mid-50s Fahrenheit. And looking at your map, it looks like there are winners and losers. I thought, okay, by the end of the century, everybody will be up in northern Canada or Siberia, but that's not what your map shows. It just shows it moving from, say, the American South as a good peak area up into the northern states of the U.S. And again, northern Europe is a good thriving zone, but southern Europe will not be.
Exactly. Yeah, that's certainly right in the European case, which I know better. So it's not like we're talking about there not being the land available, because the Earth has a strange kind of geography as we know it today, with a lot of land in the northern high latitudes. But we are potentially talking about pretty large shifts in population density and therefore in large numbers of people. And we're talking about major issues for a continent like Africa, where most population growth is projected to occur in sub-Saharan Africa, which is obviously already a pretty hot place. And countries like Nigeria in West Africa, projected to have huge population growth, they would have large areas of the country going to those temperatures not seen anywhere today of greater than 29 degrees C. And when we look over in India, we get the same problem, that large parts of the Indian subcontinent would be projected to go to these currently unexperienced temperatures.
Tim Linton, what is environmental determinism and why do you hope to avoid it?
I think environmental determinism is academics' terminology for the proposition that we're all, I guess, simply slaves to environmental conditions and that all we can do is kind of track those conditions. Clearly, we're gifted by evolution the capacity to have foresight, to adapt in all sorts of ways to challenges that come to us, be they climatic or otherwise. And we've constructed a whole economy and ways of life that at some level we would like to think give us an option, you know, to get us out of trouble as the climate is changing. But of course, not everybody has the same means to adapt or to cope with these climate challenges. Not everyone has the riches and the luxury. But yeah, what we want to avoid is an overly simple message that just because the climate changes, inevitably all the people who experience an unusual climate will do X or Y, where X might be choose to migrate, for example. Of course, that is logically going to be one of the obvious responses, and it's one of the ways in which we are very adaptable as a species. When things get bad, if we can, we often choose to move to what we think is a better place.
And we'll talk more about that as we get going here, but I also want to cover the fact that a school of European historians used to say that soil fertility determined whether civilizations thrived or fell. Soil depletion was supposed to explain the demise of Rome in the ancient world. In your wide-ranging survey, what did you find about that?
That's a great question, because we're actually continuing the work we started with this, and we're trying to understand how the rise and fall of ancient civilizations is or isn't correlated with climate and other conditions. So that's a little bit of a work in progress. But one thing to note is that ancient civilizations overwhelmingly appeared not in the optimal conditions. They tend to have arisen in relatively dry conditions. If you think of the first city-states of the Near East, modern-day Iraq and Syria, or indeed you think of the Greeks and the Romans in the Mediterranean, they're on the hotter, drier side of the climate niche. But as civilizations have developed, apparently the bulk of population density has been at cooler conditions than that, and generally wetter conditions. So we continue to work on that, but it's clear that when you think about civilization, it's best to think of it as a complex system with its own internal processes, almost like an organism, its own cycle of life, if you like. As classicists have often argued, there's a sort of possibly a natural lifetime to civilizations, or a natural phases of birth and growth and decay. But there is also, apparently, as far as we can see, some influences coming from the climate and how it sets conditions, as you said, for soil and for growing plants and so on. But I personally think that from what we've done so far, that there was something about challenging conditions climatically that probably triggered the rise of complex society. My view is people in those challenging conditions could only kind of solve the problems of existence by coming together and forming kind of new levels of organization, new kinds of infrastructure, for example, to manage scarce water resources. And that's what we now see, looking back on it, as sort of beginnings of civilization.
Right, even like the aqueduct going into Rome. So in earlier centuries, too, major cities like New York or Paris depended largely on food generated in their surrounding hinterland, as it was called. And now cities get food from all over the world, arriving from thousands of miles away. Does that disconnect from local agriculture affect your study?
Great question again, because we also chose to analyze not just where people are living, but where does food production peak? Where are domestic animals kept in terms of these climate dimensions of temperature and rainfall? And we actually find that crop production and livestock rearing have the same kind of peaks of density, if you like, density of crops, density of livestock as humans do, even though there is, as you said, quite a lot of trade on the global market of food and commodities. The truth with the food system is it's a sort of halfway house between a globalized market and a sort of national desire to be somewhat food self-sufficient, which remains an echo of the 20th century world wars, really. Even if we imagined a truly globalized food economy, it would appear that, just as there is for humans, there's a preferred niche for our food supply, as it were, and that also is destined to move as the climate changes. So from a North American perspective, it's like picturing the grain belt, again, marching northwards.
Yes, officially the worst predictions for global mean temperature by 2070 or so are maybe 2 degrees C of warming. Dr. Lenton, why do you and your co-authors suggest billions of people will experience 7.5 degrees C temperature rise compared to the year 1700? How is that possible?
So what we did was we took a reference global climate change of about 3 degrees of warming in centigrade. And the reason we chose that was actually because that's what our nations are currently committed to, inverted commas, in terms of their contributions that they propose to make to the Paris Agreement on climate change. Those contributions are not that strong at the moment, and those commitments add up to about a little bit over 3 degrees of global warming. So we thought, okay, let's map out what that looks like for where people live. And two factors come into play there. One is that when the world as a whole warms by 3 degrees centigrade, most of the world is ocean, and it warms up less than the land, and we live on the land. So typically, the land will warm in a 3 degree warmer world. It depends where you are, but it might warm 5 degrees centigrade on land, and it'll warm more nearer the poles than at the equator. But there's a second thing going on, which is where does the average person live? Population growth is overwhelmingly projected to be in already hot places, so particularly sub-Saharan Africa. So what's happening is that the distribution of people with respect to temperature is, we would say, statistically skewing to higher temperatures, because all the new people being born are being born into already hot places. So those two effects combined, the land warms up more than the global average, but also the distribution of people shifts to the hotter places. That means that the average person in the 3-degree warmer world, we looked at 50 years into the future, the average person is living about 7.5 degrees centigrade warmer conditions than the average person today.
Let's talk about a case that many of our listeners might be familiar with. A radio colleague and her husband found their old home in Washington, D.C. had become too hot and humid over the years. They were aware of predictions about climate change. The couple moved to Wisconsin to find a better climate. Will world migration be that simple as the climate heats up?
Would that it were so, in a sense. I think for the people that have the means and the desire to migrate, if the borders are welcome or the recipient countries that they might have to move to welcome them, then fine. They can choose to move and they will move, and that's always been the case in recent human history. A lot of migration could occur within country if the country is big enough and spans a big enough range of climates. And of course, the US is a case in point, which already spans a huge range of climates, especially when you count in Alaska. But for many people in the world, they're living in a nation that has much less of a climate range. And the projections that we've made would suggest that to get back to preferred or desirable conditions would have to mean leaving your country you currently live in. And that's where, for me, all sorts of questions and humanitarian concerns arise, because we're clearly living in a world now where the trend of late has rather been towards the closing of borders against migrants rather than the welcoming of a new migrant labor force. So it's hard for me not to conclude with a kind of sense of sadness that the kind of numbers of people that might be triggered to migrate from the climate change that we've analyzed, that's going to trigger all kinds of social conflict, unfortunately.
So until this year, many people that I know just assumed the world is headed towards the dreaded RCP 8.5, the worst case, business as usual, rapid hothouse. But we don't have business as usual during this pandemic. In a couple of quick months, emissions have been slashed in ways that seemed unlikely or even impossible. So talk to us about the differences you found with RCP 2.6 and the worst-case climate projections for this century. What difference could it make?
Well, this is where the good news story comes in, because roughly speaking, each extra degree centigrade of warming displaces around 1 billion people outside of the historical and present climate niche. So each degree centigrade of warming we could save by slashing emissions could save a huge amount of human disruption, and let's put it that way. And so in the best case scenario, which we're still a long way from, but if we could limit global warming to about 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial, which will be a heroic effort, and it's not the trajectory we're on yet, but if we could do it, contrasting that with the scenario we centered on in the paper, this sort of high emissions, high warming, 3 degrees warmer world, the difference in terms of the number of people whose lives are not disrupted, who are not put outside the climate niche, then numbers in the billions. Potentially you could restrict the disruption to less than 1 billion people rather than it affecting over 3 billion people.
But Tim, isn't it likely the world will still warm by at least 4 degrees, even if we slow down emissions and the rate of change, but it might just happen 100 or 200 years later?
Yeah, well, that's a very, very valid point, Alex, that the only way to stop warming is to stop the emissions completely, and that's extremely difficult to do. So actually what it amounts to is having to have technologies to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere at fairly large scales, alongside stopping most of the emissions. And we can't yet claim with our hands on our hearts that we have those technologies in a workable form at the scale required. But there's reasons to believe we could get there if we had the will to get there. But there is, as you say, the counter-argument that if we do anything, we might just slow things down. But as you say, then we could still be creeping up to these temperatures later. And all that would do is buy us time to try and, I'm trying to think of the right word, just adapt, absorb this kind of large-scale movement of people and reimagining of the future world.
But Tim Lenton, this paper does not include two other key climate-related drivers of human migration, extreme weather and sea level rise. Both can make very large areas uninhabitable. Why not include those?
So we obviously think those factors are important, and we weren't attempting, when we set out to do the study, to do a comprehensive analysis of all the factors, climate or otherwise, that might disrupt or displace people. We were actually originally motivated really just to establish whether there was a climate niche for people based on the present-day data and back to 6,000 years ago, all the data we could get from archaeology and so on. And having established that there was a climate niche, it seemed logical to ask how that niche would move in the future. But for sure, if you wanted a comprehensive analysis of all the things that might trigger people to move related to the climate, then yes, you'd want to include not just the change in the mean or average state, but the change in the extreme events. And yes, for sure, bringing sea level rise and the threat it poses to many megacities that are near sea level would be important to do as well.
To my mind, a key to your findings is deceptively simple, and it might go back to our look at environmental determinism. You make some effort to say that migration numbers that will actually happen during the next 50 years cannot simply be figured out according to raw changes in temperature. Why is that?
I say that, and we say that, because it's a complex set of influences and factors that affect whether people choose to migrate or not. I mean, in today's world, it's more about carrot than about stick. It's about people will choose to migrate because they have a sense of a better life or a better opportunity somewhere else. And if they've got the means to get to somewhere else, maybe they will choose to do that. But there's many influences on them. It might be, have they got a family member who's had a positive experience of migrating to the place they're thinking about going to? Have they got the economic means to do the migration, and all of these kind of human factors alongside any underlying drivers, including the climate ones. So there's a rich literature on this topic of environmental change and migration, and there are very vociferous arguments in the academy, at least, over these issues. So I guess it's a bit like the question about the rise and fall of past civilizations. The best way to think about the migration decisions or not of people is to think about people as complex beings with all sorts of influences on them, and to accept that, okay, for some, the climate trigger or stick will be so sharp that it might force migration if they have the means to do it. And that'd be a sad state of affairs, but that might be the case. But for many others, it'll sit within this complex of other influences on their life's choices, if you like.
Yes, I'm reminded we interviewed the American author Stan Cox, who told our listeners the internal migration south to the American Sun Belt could not be maintained without air conditioning. So a trigger for mass migration within a country may not be the heat directly, but possibly something like a massive failure of the electric power grid. The trigger might be some social or technical development rather than a heat wave per se.
Yes, I think that's a very valid perspective. That, of course, we like to think of technology as kind of offering the opportunity to insulate ourselves from the climate. But one of the most extraordinary findings I've seen in the literature of late is where economists or econometricians looked at labor productivity and other things as a function of climate. So a different study to our own, but it found not only did it find the same optimum temperature for economic productivity of 13 degrees centigrade and annual average temperature, but these studies also found that even when people work in air-conditioned buildings or air-conditioned factories, when it's, for example, hot and sunny outside, labor productivity drops. So there's clearly many subtle factors going on that can give this climate influence on our lives. And yes, technology could give us the capacity to live in the most extraordinary climates, and it already does. And of course, it gives us some lucky people the capacity to go into space temporarily, you know, to the International Space Station or whatever. But the crucial questions come around cost and how much technology, and if you are going to have the technology to live in an increasingly inhospitable climate on Earth, where's your food coming from, and who's bringing it to you, and all of these questions. And then the answer usually becomes, well, if you're rich enough, you can pretty much do anything. But the point is, we don't live in a world of equality where everybody can imagine being that rich. Instead, we live in a world where inequality and wealth gaps have grown, and the great majority of people don't have that luxury. And I'm afraid I don't see on current trends, sadly, the possibility that they will have that luxury in a few decades' time.
And despite all these things that we're talking about, Tim Lenton, do you personally believe that a mass migration beyond anything seen in human history will happen during this century due to climate change?
I believe it could happen. I sincerely hope it won't happen. And to do what we can to minimize the chance of it happening, the simplest thing to do is to limit the amount of climate change. Well, I say the simplest thing to do. I mean, it's not proving simple to do, but I mean, the obvious thing to do is to try to still strive towards fundamentally tackling the underlying climate problem. If we continue to fail on that, then for me, based on the work I've done, I can't avoid the conclusion that we're going to possibly see movements of people on a scale we've never seen. And then one has to hope for a new kind of political and social maturity, because human migration can be a great thing. It can mean a new labor force, and it can boost the economy in lots of positive ways. But you have to have the politics to go with that, the politics and the society that welcomes diversity and incoming migrants to make a better future together. And okay, some nations in the world can pride themselves on having that approach and that attitude right now, but there's some ones that can't, and that's the political reality we live in.
As we wrap up here, Tim, what else would you like to see get nailed down by science to get some of the blur reduced in these uncertainties for the new paper?
There are always many scientific things one could refine, but actually the thing I've been thinking about with this work is, can it help shift the way that we approach the climate problem? What I mean by that is, like many things in our Western society, an economic analysis of any given problem always seems to be the dominant approach. So when it came to climate change, for decades now, we've had different camps of economists basically arguing over how costly is it going to be when the climate changes, versus how costly or not is it going to be to tackle climate change. And we can debate that till the cows come home. But at the top level, maybe what the current coronavirus crisis is showing us is that we don't always have to evaluate every problem in monetary terms. When push comes to shove and it's human lives on the line, then we should be looking in more human terms at an issue like climate change. And that's really what, in a sense, the back message of our paper is here are some ways in which you can look at climate change in very human and numerical terms. So in some ways, that's what I would wish for, is that we approach the climate problem like we're approaching the COVID-19 crisis, and we put human values and human considerations first. Because after all, what the economics of climate change is teaching us anyway is that tackling climate change could actually be an economic opportunity. I'm certainly in the camp that can see how the so-called Green New Deal is a positive for people and economics as well as the climate.
We've been speaking with Professor Tim Lenton, Director of Global Systems Institute at UK's University of Exeter. Find links to this publicly available article in the journal Nature and my previous interview of Tim about planetary tipping points in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you for sharing your time and insight with us.
Thank you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
A new paper warns high heat and humidity will become deadly over the next decades as the climate shifts. Well, as American novelist William Gibson said, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed. Another paper, just released in Science Advances, says lethal pockets of heat are already appearing in some countries, including the United States. The title is The Emergence of Heat and Humidity Too Severe for Human Tolerance. From Columbia University's Earth Institute, we have reached co-author Dr. Radley Horton. He is an associate research professor at the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, a convening lead for the U.S. National Climate Assessment, and serves on numerous climate task forces with a long list of important scientific papers, which I've looked over. Radley Horton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for the chance to be here today.
We just interviewed Timothy Lenton about his new paper in Nature. They showed the climate niche, as they call it, preferred by humans, will shift during the next decades. Some places will become uninhabitable. Maybe we'll see mass migration of over a billion people. In 2017, you co-authored an article on projections for a rapid rise in global excess heat stress exposure, and you predicted that for mid to late century. What made your team wonder if that future is already here?
So I think the main thing that made us wonder if we needed to revisit the analysis has to do with the issue of spatial scales. In our 2017 paper, we were largely relying on what we call grid boxes, this sort of gridded scale, you know, maybe a 50-mile by 50-mile box, for example. And we were averaging conditions across that whole box. And we realized that in the real world, we might need to hone in at much finer spatial scales, such as the coastal cities where people live in high density, and see if some of these humid heat extremes might be much greater if we looked at a specific point and a shorter period of time. That was the primary motivation. And then a broader motivation was our earlier study had relied really solely on climate model projections. And in addition to this issue that climate models rely on averaging across these bigger areas, there's also a chance that climate models may miss some critical processes that could become important as the planet warms.
So how do we know what the limits of the human body are?
That's a great question. There's really a paradox here when we talk about humid heat. On the one hand, there is a known threshold where really anybody, even someone who's in perfect health, sitting in the shade with an endless supply of water, not exerting themselves, simply can't sweat fast enough, efficiently enough to avoid overheating. And that threshold is somewhere around what we call a wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees Celsius or 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So there is a cliff, if you will, over which theoretically it's basically impossible for a person thermodynamically to stay cool outside. But while that threshold is interesting and important from a research perspective, there's a simultaneous reality, which is that real people have pre-existing health conditions. Some of them are elderly. Some of them need to be doing heavy-duty labor, whether it's agricultural work, farming, construction, outdoors. And depending on those people's health and how hard they're laboring, they're going to experience this danger threshold at much lower combinations of temperature and humidity than that 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb I mentioned earlier. So there is a threshold above which no one can really survive, but there are also these sort of rolling thresholds depending on the actual vulnerability of people that are at much lower combinations of temperature and humidity, but that vary.
Well, frankly, the whole concept of a sliding scale of temperature and humidity is pretty hard for the public to grasp. In Canada, meteorologists call it the Humidex Index. That's what we see on TV weather reports here. And American weathercasters talk about the heat index, but that's based on something different. And I don't know what it is in Europe or India or what scientists call it for sure. If this is a matter of life and death, why is it all so confusing?
The main reason that it's confusing, I think, is because we're moving into conditions that are so far outside of the human experience. And when people have come up with these indices like the heat index, they've tended to tailor them more locally to what people are used to experiencing. And what's frightening about our paper is that we look at these really extreme combinations of temperature and humidity. They're basically off the chart. When the heat index was defined, it was defined for a world, a combination of temperature and humidity that is being exceeded more and more often in more and more places. And the effects are very nonlinear. So, you know, when temperatures are already high, when humidity is already high, if you turn that dial just a little bit higher, as the increase in greenhouse gases due to human activity do, you get a big increase in risk to people, big fall-offs in people's ability to work productively outdoors.
Well, I guess we just have to learn some of the symptoms so we'll know when it is dangerous, because we can't always rely on even the weather report to predict it accurately.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that measures you mentioned, you know, are very helpful. You know, when we see these heat warnings, for example, we know that we may not want our young people doing sports activities outdoors. We may know to take extra precautions. But it is true that because of some of these nonlinearities in the definitions, it's hard to come up with a number that everybody understands for what temperature plus humidity means. Of course, it's easy to understand a temperature reading, right? If you're just focused on temperature, we can just, you know, look at the thermometer. It's easy to understand. But as we start to bring in the humidity, it's critically important, but a little harder to quantify in a way that everybody can understand.
From my interviews with previous guests, including Camila Mora and Alex DeSherbinen, we know that heat deaths are poorly recorded. The actual cause on the death certificate might be heart attack or something else. I wonder, how big a danger is this? For example, do you think more people might die annually from excess heat and humidity than have died so far from COVID-19?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I think your overall point is absolutely right, that heat deaths go way underrecorded. A lot of people with pre-existing health conditions, whether it's heart condition, respiratory issues, renal disease, they don't show up, as you noted, on death certificates as being heat-related. But if we go back and look at the records for cities around the world, we do absolutely see that you know, when temperatures tend to be really high, there are a higher number of deaths.
And your co-author Tom Matthews published a paper in PNAS in 2017 where that team found at least 350 million more megacity inhabitants will be afflicted by mid-century by this.
You know, we worry about people because they tend to be concentrated often in near coastal zones, which tend to be low elevation. Low elevation, you know, can get that much warmer. There are also tendency for lower air quality, which can introduce simultaneous risks associated with the heat, with the air quality being poor at the same times. And as we're thinking about extreme humid heat, the ocean, which we tend to think of maybe as providing relief from the heat, paradoxically can make things worse if that nearby water body is really, really warm, when the breeze is blowing towards that coastal city, it may actually make conditions worse. That's one of the findings from our paper. When we look at some of the pretty big cities of the Persian Gulf region, Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, for example, and other areas of the Red Sea and Persian Gulf. So, yes, lots of vulnerability in cities. But I think for a lot of rural regions, this is going to be a growing risk, too. As temperatures rise and humidity gets higher, some of those places, for example, in the U.S. and parts of Canada, where maybe in the past you could get by without air conditioning, you're going to find more and more sort of oppressive evenings where you don't get that sort of natural cooling down that lets the body and other systems kind of reset.
So these killer conditions could appear out on the ocean and we would never record it.
Well, I'll tell you something we found from our study. We looked at the water temperatures in the Persian Gulf region, and we found that in 2017, for the first time, even when we look at those larger sort of grid box scales that I mentioned earlier, some of those coastal waters crossed this 35 degrees Celsius, 95 degree Fahrenheit threshold for the first time. And that is an additional line of evidence these conditions can occur, because if the water's getting that warm, the atmosphere directly above it can take up those exact same properties of high temperature and high humidity.
Well, let's get to some of the specifics in your new paper in Science Advances. What do you call these deadly heat events, and where have they already appeared, say, in the United States?
So when the wet bulb temperatures are really high, you know, we see a whole series of major impacts. The worst wet bulb events, you know, when we crossed or approached that 35 degree Celsius threshold of lethal heat and humidity for anybody, even someone who's in perfect health, some of the big risk there is coastal cities in the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia. But interestingly, we also found some values right up around that 35 Celsius threshold across Pakistan, even to some extent inland from the ocean. So we think that's some combination of the winds being able to blow off the ocean, but potentially also some interactions with the fact that the land is irrigated there. Possibly the land itself is providing a source of moisture to go with those very high temperatures. So that's where you see the highest values of all. But as we looked at other areas, such as Gulf of California, Sea of Cortez, and the area just inland from there, parts of the northwest Australia, we also saw wet bulb temperatures not quite as high, but getting up to, say, 33 degrees Celsius, 31 degrees Celsius, which, as I noted earlier, for anyone, elderly, pre-existing health conditions, you know, really going to suffer if they don't have access to air conditioning. It's going to be really hard to do any kind of outdoor labor for a prolonged period of time. The values across the United States and Canada, for the most part, don't get quite as high. The worst events we've seen in that region, somewhere on the order of 30 degrees Celsius, 31 degrees Celsius. Those types of values might happen once every few years across, say, parts of Louisiana. And what's interesting is we also found instances even further north, as far up as Wisconsin, of wet bulb temperatures, somewhere around 30 degrees Celsius.
So it's kind of a sliding scale. I mean, we've talked about 35 C, which is 95 Fahrenheit, but even 30 or 31 on this scale could be dangerous to human health?
Without question. I'd say anything above even 26 degrees Celsius could be very dangerous for human health. People who, you know, might live in a city like Toronto, somewhere like Chicago, Boston, they're sort of worst humid heat event that you might experience in a typical year or every 3 years, that's going to be a value that's well below 30 degrees. You know, it could be more like 27, 28 on that wet bulb scale. So it doesn't sound like a high number, but that's that day when people are at a huge risk of heat stroke. If you're, say, a construction worker, you're going to need to take extra precautions for sure. Not be out during the most extreme temperatures, take a lot of breaks, and consider postponing that work if possible.
It's interesting you say that, because one expert explained that there is a different heat tolerance for people, say, in Britain than there is for somebody who lives in the Mediterranean all the time, and they expect it. And people actually react physiologically differently according to what they're acclimatized to. And look, in 2003, deadly heat killed at least 30,000 people in Europe, with very high totals in France. Did that event meet your criteria, including the humidity factor?
You know, it did, but it highlights that even a little bit lower values are dangerous. The wet bulb temperatures were on the order of about 26 degrees Celsius, depending on where you look, during that 2003 event. So again, that number may not sound very high, but yeah, as you said, 30 to, you know, maybe as many 50,000 people passed away. And you're right that it does differ depending on the region. Some of that probably has to do with physiology. We know, for example, that the first heat wave of the year in a given location tends to be more deadly than when you hit those same temperatures later in the season. There's probably a little bit of people's human, you know, body response to that. But then there's also other factors to think about, like who has access to air conditioning? What's the air quality like? Is there a support network, you know, to look out for people who might be suffering? What's the sort of capacity of the state and institutions to help people in need? Are there forecasts, you know, made available, issued, and is the information communicated to people? Those are some of the other factors that are going to help influence just how vulnerable people are.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Radley Horton from Columbia University. We are discussing new science about the early arrival of deadly heat. A report last year from David Hassemeyer at Inside Climate News revealed U.S. military members have already died from excess heat. Radley, beyond the military, and you mentioned this a little bit, what other workers are at high risk as novel climate conditions appear more and more often?
I think, you know, just about everybody is the answer to that. Certainly something we're really concerned about, you know, as we look at parts of South Asia, for example, that are going to see these really high values. What's going to happen to the farmers toiling out in the fields for hours? How are they going to be affected? How are people who might have like renal conditions going to be affected in the future? That's a big concern. There were some studies out of Central America in the last few years indicating that some outdoor laborers were suffering severe kidney conditions. So that sort of thing needs further looking at. But there's also, of course, a lot of people who may not be outdoors, but are they working in an air-conditioned environment? So this could be factory workers, textile workers. You have to think about those groups as too. But there's so much we don't understand. Even, for example, how is academic performance, students' ability to learn, going to be affected by these high temperatures and high humidities? You know, my suspicion, which is really just an intuition, since I'm a climate scientist, not a medical expert, is that as we look deeper, we'll find that just about any sector, any kind of walk of life is going to be affected by this kind of extreme humid heat. And of course, it extends beyond people, too. I think we need more research on the implications for other large mammals. How are moose going to be affected? Bear, just to give a couple other examples.
Are we getting more of these extreme events? Has the number of deadly combinations increased since the 1970s?
This was really our biggest takeaway from the paper, to my mind. You're absolutely right. When we looked at the data since about 1980 or so, it almost doesn't matter which wet bulb threshold you pick. You could pick 27, 29, 31, 33, strong upward trends globally in the number of occurrences. Think something on the order of a doubling of the frequency of these dangerous events, just really in the last 40 years or so. So that's, of course, consistent with one of the simplest but most important and maybe underappreciated takeaways of climate change, that when we hear about these small shifts in average conditions, the 1 degree Celsius of global warming, the less than 1 foot, you know, barely a quarter of a meter of sea level rise, these things kind of sound like nothing, arguably. But when you go look at what they mean for the frequency of extremes, the changes are profound. The small shift in the mean can give us a huge shift in the frequency of certain types of extremes, and it opens the door to these kind of unprecedented extremes that our society is not adapted for, that our key infrastructure wasn't built, you know, for. And that's exactly where we see the biggest sort of nonlinear societal vulnerabilities. The temperature is 20 Celsius. doesn't really matter if it goes up 1 degree, but if the temperature on a given day is 38 Celsius, just temperature alone I'm talking about here, and that goes up by 1 degree, huge impact on the amount of demand for air conditioning, the risk of the power grid going out, huge impact on crops if this is happening at the wrong time in a crop cycle, and huge impact on how many people are going to end up in the hospital.
Yes, we've talked about heat deaths, but it's my understanding if a person experiences heat stroke, it may not be fatal at all, but there could be some lasting health impacts. Did you run across that?
That's outside of my area of expertise, but I suspect you're absolutely right. We've been talking about deaths, but there's all the people who just end up having to go to the hospital. And then, of course, once they're in the hospital, that can lead to additional complications. But I suspect that you're right along the entire pathway that, having a health outcome, negative health outcome, can put certain vulnerable people on a trajectory that they may not be able to recover from. And who knows, maybe even when we go and look, earlier at how young people may be affected by extreme humid heat. What about before babies are born? How is birth weight and various other outcomes affected by whether a mother is exposed to extreme temperature and humidity? There's a little bit of research on these areas, but I think a lot more is needed. And to me, it's entirely intuitive what you're suggesting, which is that, even if it doesn't kill you, it could set up some longer-term negative outcomes.
Well, even if it doesn't kill you, we certainly need to be researching all these things you just mentioned because we're living on a planet that's heating up. One thing I know for sure is one of the strange symptoms of heat stroke is confusion. People may not realize they are in danger. They may not seek shelter or help. And in a way, we're already in that position with all of global warming. Don't you think we're in danger, but we're not really seeking shelter or help?
That's a really interesting analogy. I hadn't thought about it that way. I think that's right. We're all kind of, stumbling around in these unprecedented circumstances. And it's, we're not necessarily acting. It looks like we're not acting, in our best interest. And I think it's really important, just on a more sort of basic level, your point that, as these vulnerabilities rise, we can't assume that individuals will necessarily be able to recognize all the symptoms. So if you're a construction company, for example, thinking about your workers' exposure, it's great to educate the individuals, but also everybody needs to be looking out for each other because, as you know, as you start to become disoriented, feel ill, there might be sort of direct risks of, who knows, falling, equipment you might be using. So we can't just assume that everyone will be able to sort of make the right decision or know how to react. And I think that is kind of a powerful analogy for sort of where we are as a society and facing these unprecedented risks.
Well, you mentioned rising seas, and I know you published on that. And in one presentation, you explained the possible impacts of sea levels going up 6 feet by the end of this century. That's about 2 meters, a little less. So far, we haven't seen sea level rise that would add up to that. Should we expect rising oceans to increase the pace?
I think we should expect rising oceans to increase the pace. I think that's almost bound to happen. Basically, the climate system is out of equilibrium. We're dumping so many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that greenhouse gas concentrations are rising quickly. And the more quickly they rise, the further the climate system and the ice sheets are from equilibrium. So as we turn that dial up, the rate of sea level rise should increase. The big question is, how quickly will that rate of increase rise? I think we can't rule out an upper bound of 2 meters by the end of this century. If you're taking a risk management approach, if you're responsible for a nuclear power plant potentially in a flood zone, or if you're building some critical infrastructure that has to last 100 years, military applications, I think you want to think about that upper end scenario. But I find more and more I'm actually emphasizing in a lot of my talks the lower-end scenarios, not because I think they're more likely, but because I really want to convey to people that even if things somehow broke in our favor and we didn't see as much sea level rise as we could, if we somehow only have 2 feet of sea level rise this century, a little over half a meter, I think it's likely to be more than that, but I try to convey to people that even if it were just that lower-end scenario, the impacts are going to be so profound on our society. Think about coastal flooding, whether it's sort of nuisance flooding or those 1-in-100-year catastrophic flood events where you can't get insurance above that level. We find those events with just a couple feet of sea level rise in some coastal cities in the U.S. could be happening almost 100 times more often than they did in the past. So that essentially means what used to be that 1-in-100-year high water mark could be the event that you experience every year or two, even if things break our way and we get relatively little sea level rise, and even if storms don't become any stronger, which, of course, is a big if. A lot of research suggests, you know, storms will get stronger. So we're locked into huge changes in the frequency and intensity of coastal flooding, even if we don't get that extreme sea level scenario. But of course, from a precautionary approach, knowing how vulnerable we are, we absolutely need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions dramatically so that we can do everything possible to rule out the feedbacks that could lead us on that really dangerous trajectory of, say, you know, more than 2 feet of sea level rise.
I'm still a bit stuck on the way to understand how lethal heat arrives. It pops up in a few places now and then, perhaps only for a few hours or a couple of hot days. How do we get from there to a much more dangerous world outside? Will there be startling events or just a slow boiling of the frog?
Yeah, great question. I think to really unpack that, we need more research on the almost forensics of these really extreme humid heat events of the past. I think we need more research on what was experienced in, whether it's southern Iran or the coast of the Persian Gulf. It's not always easy to get that data about the meteorology, but also about how people were affected. So I think that's the first thing we need to understand. But the overall kind of typical setup, I think, that may make some of these coastal regions in the Persian Gulf particularly vulnerable is the idea that maybe temperatures are able to creep up based on winds flowing from the land, the nearby deserts. Based on our quick look at the data, it appears that you get the really lethal heat humidity when the winds then shift and flow for an extended period of time over those very warm waters. Maybe those coastal cities somehow are just the right or just the worst spot to get the blend of the high temperatures from the land and mixing with that humidity. But it's going to be a different flavor in different places. I mentioned earlier that we also see instances of this extreme humid heat making its way up through India, up through Pakistan, to some of those, the base of some of those mountain ranges. So we need more research there for sure. The conditions are going to differ, but some common features, definitely something to look for, I think, in the future. What if our climate models miss some of those worst-case scenarios of how high water temperatures can get? If that's the case, and this is something I think we need to look at, we may be looking at a blind spot when we go to estimate.
Radley Horton, you have shared a lot of your valuable time with us. I really appreciate it. Thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.